Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A big week in Washington. The issue, improving our infrastructure. Liz Shuler of the AFL-CIO speaking out. Mine workers in Alabama standing strong after striking for 6 months now. And today on the show, the masters, mates, and pilots in the Transportation Trades Department of the Labor Federation. Welcome to the Monday, September 27th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. We have two guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with Mr. Don Marcus. Don is the president of the Masters, Mates, and Pilots. You can find all about them on their website, bridgedeck.org, bridgedeck.org. Masters, Mates, and Pilots was created to protect the rights and working conditions of members of the seagoing maritime community. They fulfill their mission by representing members in negotiations with ship owners, supporting the efforts of other maritime unions to achieve decent working conditions, and working with international organizations to improve standards and conditions in the global maritime community. Masters, Mates, and Pilots also seeks to improve the maritime working environment through political action and involvement in the regulatory process that shapes laws and regulations governing maritime work. In fact, we've referenced them many, many times regarding the Jones Act, and I'm sure we'll touch on that. That's something that was put in place back in, I believe, 1920. And throughout the years, there's been a number of leaders in the White House that suspended the Jones Act. And I'll tell you, for very bad reasons, I might add. Altogether, this union has about 5,500 members in Washington. And Don's going to talk about, well, he'll get into the role of Masters, Mates, and Pilots, how COVID has affected the industry. That was a big issue over the last 18, 19 months. And he was one of several union leaders at the White House. This was a meeting a couple of days after Labor Day. And President Biden, who many say is the most pro-union president since FDR, led the whole pack there. And they had Liz Shuler, which we played a clip on the show some weeks back on what she was doing there and her role for the AFL-CIO. Marty Walsh, Labor Secretary, was there. And about, I want to say, 50, 60 union brothers and sisters, many of them leaders like Don Marcus, were in that room. And Don said it was amazing. He's never seen anything like it. And here's a guy that's been involved in organized labor a long time. And to have the opportunity to brush elbows with people like Joe Biden, Marty Walsh, Liz Shuler, all in one room, that speaks volumes. It really speaks volumes. So he'll reflect on that. Greg Regan will be joining us later in the show. Greg heads the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, TTD.org. They did a really cool campaign right around Labor Day about essential workers. You might want to go to their website and check that out. Frontline workers that have been doing unbelievable work in the middle of a global pandemic. We'll touch on that. We'll touch on assaults against frontline transportation workers. The workers that are showing up to do their jobs are getting beat up, especially on the airlines. And I know they're talking about increasing the fines, but you still got these yahoos that don't want to wear a mask. I get it. It's uncomfortable. But we're in a pandemic. Flight crews, drivers, Amtrak workers, everybody's being assaulted. And then we're going to touch on the supply chain. And this is interesting because Greg says working people are often scapegoated for disruptions in the supply chain. How many times have you heard, well, there's a lot of people not working anymore they're lazy, they're collecting unemployment, and a lot of that has run out, and they're being blamed for the supply chain. Greg says, no, bad business dealings by freight and other companies are wreaking havoc on the economy. That's the problem, and he'll get into that. Also, a number of rail unions comprising the Coordinated Bargaining Coalition, the CBC, are negotiating together in the current round of national talks with rail carriers. They made a statement at the end of last week that those talks have stalled. And apparently the carriers were told that the members have been asked to work as essential workers throughout the pandemic while being treated more like expendable workers. And those unions comprising the CBC include the train dispatchers, railroad singlemen, machinists, boilermakers, the IBEW, transport workers, and the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, or better known as SMART. So Greg will touch on that as well. And infrastructure. Boy, this is a big week for infrastructure. We're expecting a vote probably later this week. And Liz Shuler of the AFL-CIO sent this message out. It's here. The big infrastructure and investment agenda we've been fighting for since the early 90s is now before Congress. There's the $3.5 trillion social investment package that funds education, paid leave, child care, clean energy jobs, expansion of health care access, and more. It includes other important provisions for working people, like incentives for consumers to purchase American union-built cars, and penalties for employers who violate our right to organize, which is a key piece of the PRO Act. Then there's the $1 trillion infrastructure bill that features investment in roads, bridges, transit, rail, climate change mitigation, electric vehicles, clean drinking water, high-speed internet, transmission lines being brought up to speed, and good paying union jobs involved in everything that I just talked about. Liz says Congress must pass reconciliation and the bipartisan infrastructure bill. No delays, no excuses. This is the agenda we mobilized for. This is the agenda we voted for. And this is the agenda we are poised to win if we stick together. So, this is a very crucial week, and the latest information coming out of Washington is that we're okay on that $1 trillion infrastructure bill, but the reconciliation package, the $3.5 trillion, may be whittled down. And that's coming from Nancy Pelosi, because she doesn't have enough Democrats. I just wish the Democrats would get more unified on this one, because there's a lot of components there that we need right away. Hard to believe it's been 6 months since the mine workers went on strike against Warrior Met Coal. We've been on this story many, many times, and it's just ridiculous to even talk about, because here's the background. Warrior operates two mines, a preparation plant and a central shop located in the heart of Alabama, about 15 miles east of Tuscaloosa. The United Mine Workers represents about 850 workers at these facilities. Well, 5 years ago, 2016, due to a series of questionable management decisions, Walter Energy filed for bankruptcy. However, the workers decided to save their company, preserve their jobs and their communities by sacrificing wages, time off from work, loss of overtime pay, and an end to full health care coverage. I didn't know they gave up health care. Wow. They gave up a lot. It totals $1.1 billion over 5 years, the sacrifices in cost savings, which helped the company reach revenues in excess of $4.3 billion. The union said the result of these sacrifices and an unheard-of financial comeback for the company was Warrior's blatant mistreatment of its workers, forcing them to work most holidays and complete 12-hour shifts, reaching up to 7 days a week. Is that crazy? Cecil Roberts is the head of the union. He said what Warrior Met has offered is just a tiny fraction of what these workers gave up 5 years ago. These workers are tired of being mistreated. They're tired of being forced to work and missing some time with their families. Warrior Met knows it's exploiting these workers, and it's time for this to stop. You can find more at umwa.org, umwa.org. Like I indicated, we've been on this story for quite some time. Phil Smith is with the miners as a communications director, and we're in the process of bringing him back on the show to talk more about this ridiculous situation. I mean, the workers gave up so much. And this is a Wall Street hedge fund. They don't care. I mean, and they even did rallies on Wall Street about a month ago. But this is a company that is so anti-union and so calloused about workers. Jeez. Got some good news here out of the Labor Department. They announced last week its Veterans Employment and Training Service has signed a memo of understanding with 9 organizations that have agreed to serve as partners to support vets reconnecting with work. It's called the Employment Navigator and Partnership Project, and it provides one-on-one career assistance to transitioning service members and their spouses at select military installations around the world. And they've got a number of partners. One of them is Helmets to Hard Hats out of Washington. Great organization that's tied into the building trades. And they've been very, very successful over the years getting members of the military right involved in the trades. I'll tell you, the UA was a big partner there. Their Veterans and Piping Program, I know. But there are other partners, including the American Corporate Partners in New York City, Combined Arms in Houston, Hire Heroes USA out of Georgia, 0800 in San Diego, Recruit Military in Loveland, Ohio, Veterans Ascend there in South Carolina, and Vet Jobs in Lake St. Louis, Missouri. So another good thing coming out of our Labor Department. All right, we have to break when we come back. Don Marcus, President of Masters, Mates, and Pilots.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at KellyandFerraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to our live line right now. Welcome to the show, Mr. Don Marcus. Don is president of Masters, Mates, and Pilots. Website is bridgedeck.org. He's been president for 9 years, and he's been involved in the union for over 40 years. That's a long time. Don Marcus, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Flash. It's great to be here.
And what made you get involved in this union? I often ask that to guests like yourself that rise to the ranks, especially to the presidency. I mean, it was a long time at it, but what piqued your interest in Masters, Mates, and Pilots?
Well, I shipped out with the union as soon as I got my license, shipped out of San Francisco for the better part of 20 years. And during that time when I was first started, actually the first few years in the union, we had a major labor dispute. We went on strike. We lost the strike. We lost a lot of ships. And I was amazed by the entire experience. It was really kind of a coming of age. Yeah, we were out there with picket signs, and we were told it was illegal to picket. We ultimately lost the strike, and it was all due to the supervisory provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act, and that got me interested in the union, how the union managed the strike. It was very sad. We got bushwhacked by another union, and we didn't care for the manner of how our leadership at the time I handled the entire episode. So I started getting involved in union activity, politics, when I was shipping out, and just sort of built up from there. But it took a long time. I was shipping out, got involved when I was ashore. I had some comrades that we were trying to change the leadership, and ultimately we were successful.
So you had a little fire in your belly there. So let me ask you this. How's Masters, Mates, and Pilots today? I saw on your website you have, 5,500 members? Is that still pretty much the case?
Yes, that's correct. We have 5,500 members around the country. We work on board ships and vessels of all types in deep sea and inland waters, merchant ships, which is cargo ships, container ships, tankers, ferry boats, tugboats, dredges, vessels of all types at sea and in inland waters.
And it's been difficult with the U.S. flag vessels. I remember having this conversation with you in the past, and there's not too many in that category today. Can you explain that part, Don?
Sure. Well, the merchant marine maritime industry is the first, really, to be globalized. We've been facing global competition really since before World War II, but since after World War II, a flag of convenience system with merchant ships that are owned in places like the U.S. or the U.K. or Japan or Germany, but they're flying the flags of Panama or Liberia or Malta, which avoid labor laws, they avoid scrutiny, regulation, and they undercut wages and working conditions. So we've been fighting a battle really since for the last 75 years to keep the U.S. flag on board merchant ships and keep our jobs.
When you talk about working conditions, maybe you can share some stories. I'm sure you've been hearing a whole lot over the years on how bad conditions are on those ships, especially when you compare to what you're doing with Masters, Mates, and Pilots.
Well, it's a global labor market in the maritime industry. So if, for example, the cost of a Filipino seafarers or Indian officers gets too high, they can go to Myanmar, they can go to Indonesia, they can constantly look for the lowest cost labor. And of course, these mariners they sign contracts. Generally speaking, they sign 9 to 11 month contracts where they're at sea. If they don't complete their voyage, they don't get their full pay. The conditions can be atrocious, or they can be half decent compared to their living conditions in their home country. But generally speaking, it's the lowest common denominator and the slide to the bottom.
Now, you've been very active, I know, in Washington politics. The story that you're sharing with us right now, is that resonating with members of Congress? I'm just wondering what can be done about this.
Well, it resonates thank goodness, with enough members of Congress that we survive. And the reason it resonates, in my view, the best reason is an economic security one. If you're not carrying a reasonable portion of your own foreign trade on U.S. flagged ships, then you could be held hostage to foreign ship owners. And in fact, that is happening right now. But we've always managed to keep a certain level of the U.S. flag afloat because we are seen on both sides of the aisle in Congress as necessary for national defense. We supply our troops overseas, and if we don't have U.S. flagships, U.S. crews, then our military could also be held hostage and not get the supplies they need overseas. So we've been on a baseline survival basis really for the last 50 or 60 years.
Don, what about the Jones Act? And you and I have had conversations on that, and I remember when the hurricane hit Puerto Rico. Trump was the president then, and he suspended for a time being the Jones Act. And he's not the only one. I mean, this has popped up over the years. Why don't you explain what the Jones Act is, why it's there, and why it shouldn't be suspended, especially in times of like a hurricane and a global emergency?
Well, the Jones Act supports and maintains a minimum U.S. flag merchant marine and U.S. flag mariners. It was established in 1920 after the lessons of the First World War. When the First World War started, there simply weren't enough ships to carry U.S. foreign trade. The European nations had the ships. They were using them for their own logistic necessities. And the U.S. suffered a mini depression because we couldn't export our products in the beginning, the first years of the First World War, 1914, 1915. 1916, there was an effort to establish a maritime policy, but it wasn't really until towards the end of the war that this went into effect and U.S. started building ships, and we didn't have enough ships until really the war was over. And then it was decided after the war that for national security, you had to have a baseline maritime industry, not only U.S. ships and U.S.-trained crew, but also shipyards. So the Jones Act was established, which really just built upon pre-existing cabotage laws. It protected U.S. domestic trade and protected the domestic industry of carriage of goods by sea.
So obviously it has worked over the years. But what I don't understand, when they suspended, why does that happen? Why does that even come up? I don't get that part.
Well, it comes up because there's a lot of economic interests that would like to kill the U.S. merchant marine for their own profits. Global labor is cheaper than American labor. Shipbuilding costs overseas is cheaper than U.S. Shipbuilding costs. And outfits like the Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, they would love to see our domestic industry killed and the U.S. flag go away for the benefit of the global corporations that are involved in making millions on U.S. foreign trade, which, by the way, 90% of the goods are carried by sea in foreign trade. But even in domestic trade, the idea is to kill off the U.S. merchant marine for the profit of these foreign carriers.
That's really sad, really sad. The other issue is COVID, and we're still in this pandemic, and I have to ask you, how has COVID affected the maritime industry, Don?
Well, it's been a hardship. As you can imagine, it's been a hardship for those going to sea around the world. I mean, there's some 2 million merchant seafarers of all nationalities. And for the first 6 or 8 months, really the first year, some 400,000 mariners worldwide couldn't get repatriated. They were stuck on their ships. There were no ports that would allow crew reliefs. So many mariners were 4, 5, 6 months over their return home date. Even U.S. mariners were 2, 3, 4 months held on the ships beyond their usual tour of duty, which is 3 to 4 months. And that's time on board ship where you cannot get shore leave. The COVID, in most ports, you could not go ashore. You were worried about your health. If you got sick, there was no care, appropriate care aboard ship. So it was a period of high stress, hardship, probably the hardest time to go to sea in peacetime, certainly in my career. It was just hardship, worried about your family ashore, concerned about health aboard ship, inadequate health care, denial of shore leave, and often no availability for crew change, for repatriation back to the States.
To your knowledge, did most of those, you mentioned 400,000 mariners stuck, did most of them get sick from COVID as a result since they're cooped up on the ship?
No, there were certainly a number of deaths, a number of vessels that were put in quarantine, but it was not vast illness. It was sporadic, but there certainly were deaths. We had five members of our union who were active members pass due to COVID. They were in inland water industries, but there certainly were deaths. There was hardship, a lot of illness, and the quarantining of vessels when outbreaks did occur.
So where are we now? Has the situation improved, especially with the vaccine?
It's improved, but there still are outbreaks. Not everyone is vaccinated. When a ship comes in port, the crew may be restricted and denied shore leave, but there are vendors that come aboard, there are contractors that come aboard, longshoremen come aboard, pilots come aboard. There's still certainly outbreaks. It's still happening. It's more under control now because there are more vaccinated mariners and the face masks are generally worn. They're required to be, but there are outbreaks, but it's not the way it was, I'd say, a year ago, certainly.
Well, at least it's getting better. Sounds like it is anyway. Don Marcus is joining us on our live line. Don is president of Masters, Mates, and Pilots. Website is bridgedeck.org, bridgedeck.org. Greg Regan, on behalf of the Transportation Trades Department of the Labor Federation, will be joining us later in the show, talking more about essential workers and the supply chain shortage. This is an interesting take on what's happening, not just in the United States, but the entire world. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our Raising Wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, we are available on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate a 5-star rating. Let's go back to our live land and rejoin Don Marcus. Don is president of Masters, Mates, and Pilots. I want to talk about that White House meeting that you attended, but you wanted to mention an event that happened last week that needs some airtime. What's the story?
Yes. Yeah, thanks, Flash. Yes, as we mentioned earlier, the Merchant Marine is key to national security and military security. And an event happened last week, 75 years belated, but the American Merchant Marine veterans of World War II have been finally awarded a Congressional Gold Medal for their World War II service. And there was an event held here by the American Merchant Marine Veterans Association at our training facility where 22 World War II veterans of the Merchant Marine were present, along with a couple hundred well-wishers, and they received the mock-up. They haven't received the medal yet because it's being made of the Congressional Gold Medal for the Merchant Marine service. But this just goes to show that the Merchant Marine is really a hidden industry. 75 years after the Second World War, they finally receive some due recognition after years of trying. The Merchant Marine had the highest casualty rate other than the Marine Corps in the Second World War, and some 8,000 mariners lost their lives, U.S. Union member mariners, and it's something that's hidden in our history books, and it deserves a recognition. And when people talk about the Jones Act and the U.S. Merchant Marine, they unfortunately forget about the sacrifices of the mariners that came before us, the Liberty ships, and the fact that the Merchant Marine is the fourth arm of defense. And I just wanted to make that point and give these wonderful veterans the recognition that they deserve and they earned, and many did not come home.
Don, it's hard to believe it took 75 years for that to happen. How did it happen? Is this something that Masters, Mates, and Pilots said, hey, this is long overdue?
Well, many organizations did. We supported the effort, of course, but it was really credit due to a handful of determined American Merchant Marine veterans of World War II and an organization called the AAMV, the Association of American Merchant Marine Veterans, and they have been crusading for decades to get due recognition. There was some recognition given in 1988, but no compensation, no GI Bill, nothing of that sort. And finally, after 75 years, they're getting this symbolic pat on the back of the Congressional Gold Medal.
Wow. Heck of a story, no doubt about that. All right, talk to me about this meeting at the White House, which happened a couple of days after Labor Day. I saw it on the AFL-CIO website, and in fact, we even played a little snippet of Liz Shuler, the new president of the AFL-CIO. Hey, before we get to that, what do you think of that transition from Trumka to Liz Shuler? What's your thoughts
on
that?
Well, I think it's certainly historic. And it's a changing of a generation, and to see Liz there is fantastic, and Fred Redmond with her. I think it's a historic moment, the first female president of the AFL-CIO, and it's a brave new world. But I have to say that Richard Trumka will never be forgotten, and was a wonderful leader, and passed long before his time. Tragic for the labor movement to see him pass at a time when labor's finally getting some traction in White House and hopefully in Congress.
Boy, you're not kidding about that. A lot of traction. Well, you got to tell me about this meeting that you were in the audience. How many people were actually in the audience
I figured there were about 75, maybe 100. There were labor leaders, some rank and file union members, press. It was a wonderful event, And you know, I was in shock, very much surprised to get an invitation to visit the White House. Certainly, my old shipmates and myself, we would have never figured I'd be invited to the White House. And I was a little nervous at first. Walked into this reception area, and there's a group musicians playing a violin, so I figured, this can't be good. But it was really inspiring to go in the White House, and the artwork alone and the furnishings and the view out the windows of the mall in Washington was really impressive.
Don, what did they tell you this was about? I mean, it was a celebration of labor, right? And we found that afterwards. But what did they say to you, why they wanted you to come to the White House?
Well, I think it was clear it was a Labor Day event, and it got delayed because President Biden had been up in New York with the flood, you know, helping witnessing the flood damage up there.
Yeah.
So we knew it was a Labor Day event, but it was a wonderful event. And as you said, Liz Shuler spoke, Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh spoke, and they gave excellent speeches. And all due respect, of course, to the passing of Richard Trumka. He spoke about labor law reform and the achievements of the labor movement. And a rank-and-file woman from the UFCW spoke. She was a lady that gave vaccines to the general public. And she spoke about her experiences, both losing her mother to COVID and her experiences dispensing vaccines. So that was great. But the real, of course, the highlight was listening to President Biden.
Now, what did Biden say at that event?
Well, he gave a really great, warm, heartfelt tribute to Richard Trumka. And he spoke at length about the labor movement. He spoke for over a half an hour. And he spoke about his support for the critical role that the labor movements had building the middle class. He discussed the inequity and stagnant wages for workers that's happening in the last couple of decades, actually since 1979, times when the stock market has often been booming, a time now particularly when CEO pay is mushrooming. And he made these points quite strongly. And he emphasized his plans regarding the PRO Act, his infrastructure bill. And, of course, he got a very warm reception from everyone there when he spoke about labor legislation, labor law reform, tax equity, building back better. He even gave a pat on the back to Bernie Sanders. And it was a great, warm speech coming from the President of the United States about labor. It was almost shocking. But he also expressed his intention to be the most pro-union president on record. And he said that unions had been instrumental throughout his career and his life. And then, just to sort of emphasize that point, he said, after all, he sleeps with a AFT member every night, the same one. So that was pretty funny. And, of course, he was talking about his wife.
Right.
And, you know, to hear an American president give such fulsome credit and praise to the union meeting, union movement, after the 4 years we experienced before President Biden, it was shocking and something I'd never heard in my lifetime, whether it was Labor Day or not. It was just a wonderful thing to hear. And then when it was over, President Biden didn't just walk out the door. He walked down off the podium there and came down and whoever wanted. He shook people's hands. He took pictures. I got a couple of pictures with him. Anyone who wanted to speak to him just came up. And his warm, genial manner and greetings was fantastic. And
yeah.
He spoke for over a half an hour, unlike our previous president, and didn't say anything nasty about anybody.
Right.
It was great. It really was a highlight of my time here as a union representative.
Well, I tell you, 42 years involved in the union movement. You know what, Don Marcus, you deserve that kind of treatment after what you've been through so many years. And you saw, you know, during that time period, you saw the decline, the lack of density in organized labor. Organized labor was like one out of three members in 1953, and it's far from it. And we're seeing some pockets of organizing going on right now. And to have a president like that, like Joe Biden in the White House, is in fact, many are saying, and maybe you would agree, they say he's probably the most pro-union president since FDR. What's your thoughts?
Oh, I think he is. Like I said, I'd never heard anything like this in my lifetime from any president. Absolutely. I wouldn't dispute that at all. And he said that actually he wanted to be the most pro-union. And I think certainly he is. And we just hope that we can get some legislation passed in Congress, get the PRO Act passed, and get some forward movement on labor law reform. It's sadly needed if inequality and some of these outrages are going to be pushed back.
I hear you, brother. Well, I'm going to leave it on that note. Talk about a high. Holy moly. That's a great thing.
It was. No doubt.
Don, you take care. Stay safe. Don Marcus, president of Masters, Mates, and Pilots. Website is bridgedeck.org. You stay safe. And next time you get an invite to the White House, let me know if there's an extra seat available, okay?
All right, Flash. Take care, and thank you very much. Have a good one.
Take care. All right, Don Marcus on our live line. We're going to take a quick break. Greg Regan on behalf of the Transportation Trades Department of the Labor Federation coming up next.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Ironworkers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 ironworkers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union ironworkers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our ironworkers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And you can check us out on Facebook. That's AWF Union Podcast, which is also our Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to live line number two right now. Welcome one of our regulars. That would be Greg Regan. Greg is head of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, which is a collection of about 30-plus unions involved in the transportation sector. And he's telling me off the air he was in that White House meeting with Don Marcus. Greg, welcome back to the show. I didn't get my invite. I'm really upset.
Thanks, Flash. Happy to be here.
So what's your take? Don was just still glowing from that White House meeting of a couple weeks ago. That had to be pretty cool, huh?
I mean, it was wonderful. It was, you know, there was a rank and file worker who spoke about what she experienced during the pandemic. Liz Schuler spoke, and the president and Marty Walsh. And afterwards, the president, I mean, they made it very clear that this house, the White House, is labor's house. And yeah. We are welcome there. And that we're going to get good policies out of this White House. And then he came out and spoke to everybody. And it was really a special thing to see.
Yeah, Don ran it all down. It was shocking and refreshing at the same time to be in that room. That Great stuff. Great stuff. All right. What's going on with the frontline workers and the assaults? And I know it's been really ugly. I'm hearing that they want to up the fines on that, but maybe you can give us the latest on that, Greg.
Sure. I mean, we have, in the aviation sector alone, just since January, we've had over 4,000 unruly passenger reports, over 3,000 mask-related incidents. We've had 755 investigations initiated by the FAA. 85% of flight attendants have dealt with an unruly passenger in the first half of 2021. This is getting out of control. What the FAA, unlike other agencies, the FRA does not have the ability to do civil penalties, but the FAA does. And there are laws in the books that they can initiate to make sure that people are held accountable for acting like jerks on airplanes. And we're not talking about increasing the penalties right now. We're talking about actually just levying them as they're written in the laws. And they've actually, the FAA has been enforcing it to the highest extent that they're able to under the law. We want them to continue to do that because while it's gotten a lot worse, this is not new. This is not, people have misbehaved themselves on airplanes for a long time. And yeah, this is just a higher spate of it, and it's been a real sharp increase since once people decided that wearing a mask is apparently a really big problem for them. But it's we just want them to continue to use every aspect of the law they can to enforce this stuff. And when it comes to transit and rail, they don't have the same tools in their belt, at least on a federal level. And we need a lot more support there to make sure that people are able to do their job safely.
Now, when it comes to airlines, let's talk about that. If you get on board a plane in the United States, mm-hmm. you have to wear a mask. Is that pretty much the rule right now?
Yes, it's the federal mask mandate is still in place. You have to wear a mask if you're on a bus, if you're at an Amtrak, and certainly inside an airport and on a plane. So it is the requirement by law.
And what's the issue here? It's like a personal liberty. People don't want to wear the mask because that's their choice. Is that the reaction here?
I guess so. Personally, I would like the liberty to be able to travel safely. So I'm perfectly happy to have a mask on and have everybody else wear one too, so that we can keep everybody safe and continue to travel. But no, I guess there are people where that's just a bridge too far.
Yeah. It's really sad, and I don't know. You mentioned the penalties. I hope they up them even more, though, because I know there's some discussion on that, but I just don't understand what part of the equation they don't get on that. And these people, I mean, serious fines, possible jail time. I don't know. Let's just move on to the supply chain. Now, that's another issue.
Yeah.
Now we're hearing, there's not enough people working anymore. And restaurants are hurting, manufacturing's hurting. I mean, I'm truck driving. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of different stories on that. What are you hearing on your end as far as the supply chain? Because we're hearing products, well, for instance, in the automobile sector, we got the semiconductors that are typically made, I believe, in Korea. And there's cars on the lot that are just sitting there because they don't have the computer chips in them. What's your, or maybe the Transportation Trades Department, view on this supply chain shortage?
There is a problem right now in terms of the supply chain, but it's not the problem that people are trying to identify in the media. I would say the biggest problem is connectivity between the freight rail industry and the ports. Freight rail has been doing, I know we've talked about this before, precision scheduled railroading, a new business model that is supposed to increase efficiency. What it really does is they're trying to reduce their overhead. We've had 30% of the rail workforce reduced in the last 6 years, and that's not pandemic related. That is by design by management to try to trim down their workforce as far as they can. And when you have a surge like this, when you have an emergency, and you don't have the people in place that are able to actually complete the work, you're going to have problems like the ones we're seeing right now. We have, and it's getting people's attention. Marty Olbermann, who's the chair of the Service Transportation Board, he wrote a letter to the railroad CEOs asking information about congestion and workforce rates. There are real cause and effect issues here when it comes to them trying to carve out every bit of profit they can from a Wall Street perspective, and not actually about they're focused on their responsibility, because let's be honest, they have common carrier responsibility in our country to actually perform the work they're doing.
So this sounds like an accident in the making. It was bound to happen because of the cutbacks by the freight rail industry. Would you say the pandemic just made it worse, or just called attention to it?
Yeah, I think the pandemic did make it worse. I think you go across the board where you've had, you know, a lot more. You have health restrictions. You have people that need to be able to, like, if all of a sudden someone got exposed to the virus and they have to quarantine for 14 days, but you're already operating at skeletal levels, that's when you're going to see these types of spikes in but whether it be on the ports or whether it be in the railroads. But yeah, we've been calling attention to this for years, and people have not been paying that much attention. And now we're all eating the dish that was served here.
Yeah. So my question with the Biden administration, you got a union friendly administration here. Mm-hmm. I got some indication that they're looking into this. Can they force their hand on this and say, hey, wait a minute, these cutbacks got to stop. You got to start hiring more workers.
We look, certainly, like, the STB is able to, they are the regulatory board to make sure that they're, that the railroads are operating within law, and they do have, as I mentioned before, common carrier requirements. They have requirements where they need to be able to service everybody equally. So the STB has a role here to play to make sure that they're fulfilling their obligations as a Class I freight railroad. The mm-hmm. FRA, I mean, from our view, one of the biggest impacts, one of the things we care about, is the safety. You look at some of our freight rail unions, you've had the highest levels of fatalities or amputations in years. And a lot of that's because, you know, people are being overworked. They don't have the resources. They're trying to rush through inspections, all these problems. So if there are safety violations, we're going to make sure the FRA is going to be inspecting that and making sure that they can levy fines as necessary to make sure that these types of things are not happening in the future. So I think there are a number of tools the administration can take. Unfortunately, we cannot regulate a business model, but when it comes to safety and when it comes to the obligations of the law, I think we have a pretty good argument to make.
I get it. You're not going to tell them how to run their business, but at least with the safety aspect, hopefully they can hire more people and make sure that everybody's job is safe. Makes a whole lot of sense. Speaking of jobs, I just want to salute you guys and what you did on your website, ttd.org. Those of you listening right now, you might want to check the video that was posted there right around Labor Day weekend about the essential workers. And we're talking frontline transportation workers. And, Greg, I tell you, I still can't get over, you know, the flooding they had in New York City a couple weeks back when I saw the bus driver driving the bus with like 2 feet of water in it. I mean, it's just amazing. And you talk about the flight attendants being assaulted, all the people on the front line that are getting us through this pandemic. They need to be saluted. And I encourage those of you to check out that video. Keep doing that kind of stuff. You know, I think it's important just for morale, you know, really important.
Yeah, we will. We have John, our communications director, has done a great job with all this. But, you know, what we're pointing out, the problems we're pointing out here that got worse during the pandemic have always existed. These are problems that we want to make sure that we can solve for the long term, not just right now while we continue to fight to get out of this thing. You know, we these workers have always been essential. They have always been the people that keep our country moving. And we just want to make sure, and of course, everyone recognizes it now. A lot of people recognize all the work they did. They didn't have the opportunity to telework. They didn't have the opportunity to stay home. And they truly kept us moving. But they've always done that. And we want to make sure people recognize that. So as we get out of this pandemic, that these are essential workers for our country, and that we hope that the people recognize that.
Amen, brother. Greg Regan, president of the Transportation Trades Department. You take care. We'll talk to you next month, all right?
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
TTD.org is that website. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, our independent labor voice, Tom Buffenbarger, the IBEW, and the Rhode Island Building Trades. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.